introduced the concept of symplectic manifold and the notion of Hamiltonian classical mechanics. So today I want to guess a little more on Hamiltonian picture. And explain the relationship between the Hamiltonian picture and the Lagrangian picture. So, as Giuseppe explained, a Hamiltonian classical mechanical system is the following. A symplectic manifold . So for now we're discussing classical mechanics. This will be a finite dimensional symplectic manifold, but if we were to discuss classical field theory, this would become infinite dimensional. And the second piece of data is a function h on M, which is called the Hamiltonian. So, as Giuseppe explained, from the Hamiltonian, we can build the Hamiltonian vector field. Hamiltonian vector field by asking that x, h, contracted with symplectic form is equal to dh. So in coordinates, if omega is some dq I wedge dpi, it's always possible to find coordinates locally where the symplectic form looks like this. These special coordinates are called Darboux coordinates. And the vector field x, h is equal to some, how does it go? Minus plus
Papa, could you explain the notation, the inverse wedge?
This notation here? Okay, if x, this is a vector field, is this is just a general notation, so I'll use coordinates x instead of pq. Fi d by the xi, and I have a differential form omega ij dx I wedge dx j, then x wedge omega, it's what you get by contracting. This is a, you know, a covariant and a contravariant tensor, so I can contract one index here with one index here. So I get f I omega I j dx j minus f j omega I j dx I. And since omega is anti-symmetric, this is really twice that. Now, this is a physics institute. We can ask, what is the physical meaning of the Hamiltonian? So H is the total energy. Kinetic energy plus the potential energy of the system. Let's write out two examples. If I have a free particle, the symplectic manifold is R2, the coordinates E, Q. Q is position. E is momentum. And the symplectic form, I'm going to take my convention, so it's dq dp. So if I have a free particle, that means there's no potential energy, so it's only kinetic energy. So the Hamiltonian should just be in terms of the momentum. Hamiltonian is just kinetic energy, so that's half E squared. And now, let's figure out, like, what is the Hamiltonian vector field? We have this formula above. The vector field, you get it by some game involving differentiating the Hamiltonian above. And if you look at the formula, the Hamiltonian only depends on P. So the Hamiltonian vector field is XH is equal to EU. So let's draw this and see what this means. So if I have positive momentum, then my position moves. That's, you know, what you expect. If I have something which has momentum, then it's moving. And if I have negative momentum, it moves the other way. This is extremely simple. So, well, it is extremely simple, but the thing it tells you is that if you want to interpret E as being momentum, you better have such a term in the Hamiltonian. Because this term in the Hamiltonian tells you that when you have momentum, then you're moving. Let's do the second example. This is the harmonic oscillator. So, M is OR2, as before. Omega is EQ wedge DP, as before. But now I want to consider a setting where I have both kinetic and potential energy. So maybe I have, this is Q, something attached to a spring, and the potential energy is going to be Q squared, because when I stretch the string, I'll have some potential energy. So I'm going to have kinetic energy, the same as before. So the Hamiltonian is half P squared plus Q squared. Okay, so let's calculate what our spring does using this formulation. The Hamiltonian vector field is P del Q minus Q del P. Now, this minus sign is essential. And if we look back where it came from ultimately from the fact that I wrote it as dQ dP and not as dP dQ. In other words, it's related to the fact that two forms are antisymmetric. Let's draw this vector field. And this is P, this is Q. So the first thing is, as before, if I have positive momentum, then I'm moving. So that's going to go like that. The second thing is, well, if my position is positive, Q is positive, then my momentum is going to be decreased. So my momentum will decrease over here. Well, that's what you would expect if I have a spring, right? If I'm stretched out, positive Q, I'm going to be forced the other direction. And if you're somewhere in the middle, it goes like that. So you can kind of convince yourself that the flows will look like circles. So if I start at a point here, I'm going to flow around in a circle in my Hamiltonian system, which is, of course, reflecting the fact that your spring moves back and forth. More concretely, if E of t is cos t, Q of t is sine t, and of course, this vector, P dot, Q dot, is going to point along the direction of that vector. You're saying that the time derivative of my position momentum is given by that vector field. That's the equation describing how a particle moves in this Hamiltonian. Okay, any questions, or is this all straightforward? So I hope this wasn't too boring for some people. I'm sure some people have seen Hamiltonian mechanics before, but some people might not have, so it's good to see. So there's one Small point. Can anybody see? I wrote down the Hamiltonian. Can anybody just tell immediately from that Hamiltonian why the flows are circles?
Energy conservation?
Yes, exactly. So the Hamiltonian is constant along flows of XH. So that is XH, this vector field times H is equal to zero. This is because if we just look at the equations, minus LH or, if you like, Giuseppe defined the Poisson bracket, didn't he? XH times any function is the Poisson bracket H and F, but Poisson bracket of H itself is zero as the Poisson bracket is antisymmetric. So the Hamiltonian, like the total energy is constant along this flow, but so this statement here is indeed energy conservation. And because the loci where the Hamiltonian is constant, that's just the circle. So these must be the flows. Okay, so this is all very elementary and fun. So what I would like to do now is move on to discussing the relationship between Lagrangian and Hamiltonian mechanics. Unless, are there any questions in the discussion so far? Okay.
Kevin?
Yeah?
It's Giuseppe from Zoom. What exactly are you planning on doing about the relationship between Hamiltonian and Lagrangian? Because that's going to be my own work that I just released today.
Oh, well.
But I can just change it if you want to do that.
Oh, sorry. No, I thought that.
It's okay. It's my bad. I didn't let you know in advance.
I think I'd meant to have that in the syllabus. How were you going to treat it, Giuseppe? Were you going to do the Legendre transform? Or?
Yes.
Yeah, I wasn't going to take that approach, so it's okay. It'll be complimentary.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Okay. Suppose we have a field Y, or many fields, so I'm going to work super generally. Some field, I could have many fields. In fact, the analysis I will discuss will work perfectly fine if I doesn't depend just on time, but also depends on some space variable. And then we're discussing classical field theory. And I have some Lagrangian of I and its derivatives. And the action function. I want to build from my Lagrangian symplectic manifold with a Hamiltonian. So the very first thing we need to figure out is, what is M? So the phase, given a Lagrangian system, the symplectic manifold is called the phase space. So it's the space of solutions to the Euler Lagrange equations. So then, you know, of course, we're going to have to figure out, why does this space naturally come with a symplectic form? But before we get there, we should look at the very simplest example of a free particle. For example, L phi is phi del t squared phi, output a factor of a half. So the action just to check, everybody, you guys have certainly discussed the Euler Lagrange equations in field theory, right? So I don't need to read. Okay. Euler Lagrange equations. That the second derivative of phi is 0. So that means I can write phi is u plus e times t. Any solution of the Euler Lagrange equations, you know, its second derivative is 0. So when I expand it in t, the t squared, the coefficient of t squared vanishes. So any solution looks like this. That means that u, which is the value of phi at the origin, and v, which is the value of the derivative of phi at the origin, are coordinates on the phase space. Now, you may have said, you know, why am I describing it in this kind of abstract way? I know perfectly well that we need to talk about position and momentum. That's what we have. However, that's not really satisfying. Suppose somebody gives you a very complicated Lagrange, say gravity. It has gauge symmetry in it. Maybe there's terms which have first derivatives as well. Maybe there's terms with fourth derivatives. What do you do? This procedure will always give you the correct answer. Whereas it's easy to make a mistake just by naively thinking, oh, we need position and momentum, not only conjugate variables. One elementary mistake people often make is that when you deal with fermions, us fermions have a first derivative in the action and not a second derivative. You don't need to throw in a conjugate variable. this formalism will give you that automatically. So I've described how to get the manifold, but how do we get a symplectic form?
I'm failing to see how in the fermion case, the difference between the naive answer and what this will give us.
Yeah. Okay, so let's, instead of discussing fermions, let's consider an action which has a first derivative. So if I had two fields, phi 1, phi 2, the Lagrangian is integral phi 1 del t phi 2, then the equations of motion are that.
Sorry, can you repeat why did you define your phi v q plus pt? And
this is the come from? Any solution can be written in this way. Because any function of one variable, it can take its Taylor expansion.
Yeah.
And because the second derivative vanishes, everything except for the first two Taylor terms are zero.
Oh, I see.
It would have been more, if I had a mass term, it would have been more complicated.
But how do you generalize this? Because you just saw the d squared is zero and say, oh, okay, this is kind of simple. But if you had a very complicated differential equation,
yes,
it's not at all trivial
to see the math. Absolutely. So and that's absolutely correct. Suppose I had phi squared term 2. If the equation was like this, like that, then I could expand phi as phi naught plus e phi 1 plus e squared phi 2. And I look at this equation, and you see, well, phi 2 has to be like minus phi 0 or something. So every other term is determined from the first two.
Okay.
That's, you're never going to get something quite so simple. Sometimes you will. You generally will not get something quite so simple, but you will always find the series expansion is determined by the first couple of terms in some coherent way.
But this is all contingent upon the fact that you're in your Lagrangian like that, so you have a d squared phi and it makes life easy.
Yes, exactly. And so if we looked at this example where I had a first derivative, then well, these are constant, and then I only have phi 1 at 0, phi 2 at 0. Our coordinates. If I had a fourth derivative, then the value and the first three derivatives are then independent. And those would be the coordinates of it.
Yeah.
So somebody asked about fermions. So to treat fermionic fields carefully, we need a slightly different language than the language of symplectic manifolds. We have to talk about symplectic supermanifolds because they're anti-commuting variables. But let's not worry about that. Fermions have a first order kinetic term, and this analysis tells us that the coordinates in the phase space do not involve any derivatives of the fermions.
Yeah? I don't quite understand
understand when I have a first order time derivative, then phi 1 acts as some Lagrange multiplier. So effectively, it imposes the constraint that this equation of motion is satisfied. So are the fermion systems fully constrained in this sense?
There's no invariant meaning to saying a field acts as a Lagrange multiplier. You could also say phi 2 acts as a Lagrange multiplier if you just play integration with
points. But one of them is,
so in some sense. But it's, they're all fields, they're all perfectly fine fields.
If phi 1
and phi 2 independent. Were you tempted to say it's a Lagrange multiplier, therefore we can throw it away? Or?
I guess I'm somehow asking whether this phase space makes sense physically if I know that one of the fields is not really dynamical.
But they are both dynamical. The fermionic action looks exactly like this. We see fermions every day.
No, yeah.
They are dynamical. There's, I mean, you are correct that if I was to go through this analysis and figure out the phase space, the Hamiltonian would, in this case, would be zero. It is, however, a good model for quantum mechanical fermion. Yes, I mean, you could say what really happens is if I have an actual physical fermion, there's another term here. These are fermions. This time derivative should be replaced by the covariant derivative. And this other term is the gauge field, like the photon. And that's what's giving you the Hamilton.
Just to emphasize, so the point of this discussion was to say, well, the space of solution is going to be parametrized by two parameters. One of them we're going to define as the original coordinate space, and the second one we're going to leverage the second parameter to induce, well, an extra parameter space, and the union of the two is going to be the.
Yes. Yeah. But and the point was to say, of course, you already knew that we needed position and momentum, so I didn't need to tell you that. But the point of this formalism is to say that, like, if you're given some really complicated example, you might not know what to do. This is the right thing.
Sorry, the last word was, this is what to do?
This is what to do in any example. If you for some strange reason, had an action with loads of derivatives and something weird stuff.
Okay.
Would it be possible to have that a term that is not quadratic in the fields, but something different so that the manifold is not even? Like the dimensions?
That's an excellent question. So with ordinary bosonic fields, the manifold has to be of even dimensions because the symplectic form always looks like dp dq, and for each p it has to be a q. But with fermionic fields, which are anti-commuting variables, symmetry properties of the symplectic form are different. So it could look like d psi d psi, and it could be of odd dimension.
For the free particle example, for the momentum, why are we specifically choosing delta t of pi at zero?
Because the Hamiltonian picture is the phase space is something associated to space. You choose a spatial slice. The phase space is something built from that there.
So we need a slice.
Yeah, exactly. So the next thing I want to discuss is how do we get the one form on the two form on the phase space. So if M is the manifold of solutions to the Euler-Lagrange equation, now if you just gave me some random differential equation, I can look at the manifold of its solutions. There's no reason that would be symplectic. Euler de Grand equations are special equations. And the fact that it comes from variational principle is going to give my manifold the symplectic form. So in fact, what we will find is one form, alpha on M, called the variational one form, so that omega is B alpha. So let's think a little bit about what this is going to mean. So a point in M is this blackboard visible? Do you guys see it okay? Yeah. So a point in M is a field configuration, which satisfies the Euler de Grand equations. The tangent space is a first order variation of phi. So it's an expression like phi plus delta. A one form well what's a one form? It's a tangent space, it's a vector. The one form is a covector. So it's something which takes a tangent vector and gives you a number. Sines to phi and del phi a number.
Understand why the tangent bundle is phi plus delta phi. Is there like a picture you could draw?
Yeah. So if I take my blackboard, there's a point in the blackboard. A tangent vector is like an arrow, right? We learned in undergraduate calculus, a vector field is an arrow at every point. So a vector at a point is an arrow. So I think of it as phi plus delta phi, because so I move a little bit in the direction given by that arrow.
And so it would be any general direction, so it would give us like the plane?
Yes, exactly. The set of tangent vectors is two-dimensional. So in this case of a free field, phi is given by p plus qt, and delta phi, I can vary p or I can vary q, so it's two-dimensional.
A question about the one form.
Yeah.
It seems like a very stringent requirement that we're requiring it to be exact. Is there some...
Excellent question, yes. So what? This is a really awesome question. So not every symplectic manifold is exact. Like I could take the two sphere is a symplectic manifold, but it is not exact. Because if you know about cohomology, there's a class in H2. I don't know if you study cohomology, but turns out if I wanted to engineer a quantum mechanical system which had a finite dimensional Hilbert space, it should come from something compact manifold with finite volume, in which case the symplectic form cannot be exact. So what's going on is, in the case the symplectic form is not exact, in the path integral, the thing that appears is e to the s. And e to the s always makes sense. But in the cases when this does not hold, there isn't really an s. There's only an e to the s.
Did we define the tangent space in such a way that you take a point in the manifold, and then you take another close point to that, and then you add them up, and you say each direction is the tangent space? Because before we used the charts, we went to the Rn, and then we used that kind of to define what close means. But here we just add two points in the manifold directly that using the charts.
This is like the abstract definition of the tangent space. Like one textbook definition is to say, if I have a point in my manifold, every curve through that gives me a tangent vector, and then there's equivalence relation where they've two curves, you know, which are the same first order are viewed as the same tangent vector. Now you're asking, like, why is this the same thing as what you know about Rn? So once you choose coordinate charts, then the two definitions are the same, because if I'm on Rn, then if I have a vector at that point, like a way of moving my point a little bit, that is manifestly a tangent vector.
So this could count as a new definition as well, I think.
Yeah, this is an alternative coordinate independent definition of a tangent vector. How you should think about it. It's a way of moving your point a little. And of course, you know this, right? Because...
You
write expressions like dl, dphi when you study the Euler de Grand equation. That's clearly a tangent vector. You're differentiating.
Maybe one thing that I find weird is just that the notation seems to suggest a different analogy, in the sense that I would associate like dx would be a one form.
Yes.
The differential, the variation, is somehow associated with the tangent vector instead of with the cotangent one. So it's there's a false analogy that's being traced in my mind because of that.
Okay, so what do you think? Why is dx a one form? So if I have coordinates, say x. Like, suppose I take a tangent vector. That tells me how to move this point a little bit. And then I take x, the value of x at the new point. This is a number I assign to a tangent vector. That's really the x. Okay, so is everyone reasonably happy with this? The tangent vector is a little variation. And you should think, this is my original field phi, and then my variation is some kind of, I'm just moving it a little bit. It's the picture we should have in mind.
Yes? I just want to backtrack a little bit. So here you have the space of solution to the Euler Lagrange equations, right?
Yes.
Now, if let's say my equation of motion has boundary conditions, right, does that mean that I have to start appending it as a boundary term in the Lagrangian, or?
This is, what's going to happen is variational one form comes from the boundary terms. So when we talk about the Euler de Grand equations, it means that if I verify, and I assume that my variation goes to zero at the boundary. So the first order of variation of the action under a variation which goes to zero at the boundary, that needs to be zero if and only if phi satisfies Euler de Grandes equations. In other words, the usual definition of Euler de Grandes equations throws away any boundary stuff because you assume their variations like this. So how do I define the one form? I need to say, if I vary my field a little bit, I want to produce a number. Well, so let's look at the Lagrangian of phi plus del phi minus Lagrangian of phi, and I'm always going to use the convention that I drop terms which are quadratic in the variation. So now we know that the integral of this is zero if del phi goes to zero at e is plus or minus infinity. Well, if del phi doesn't go to zero, though, there might be something there. But what this equation tells us is that this expression must be a total derivative. It's a total derivative of something. And this something, well, we can now pick up the boundary term associated to this. And I'm going to, there's going to be two boundary terms, same, take my integral to be over this range. We define.
Sorry, I'm kind of confused. Are you implicitly defining charts somewhere, or because everything is going from zero to infinity, everything is kind of smooth? And I know manifold should be smooth, but we check this smoothness going to.
Okay. I think is the confusion that. So I'm always. I have a field living on. It has a world line. The world line of my field is just the real numbers, time. That's a different space than the space space.
Oh, okay. So you don't have a complicated manifold for your fields?
No, our fields might be a complicated manifold, but a field is a function of time. So all I'm saying is time is not a complicated manifold.
Oh, okay.
At each time, my field is a function of time, which might live in some complicated space. But time itself is nothing. The real numbers.
Wait, sorry, so then delta phi, but that change in phi is not a change in time, it's a change in the field at the same time?
This one here? Or this one here?
The top one.
This is this is like the kind of thing you do when you have the Euler de Grandes equations. You take a field and you vary it a little bit.
Yeah, but I was wondering, I don't know, with this trying to make it a more rigorously mathematical description, it feels a little. Okay, so should we just switch to physics brain?
I mean, the ultimate goal is that your two brains should be united. But yes. I mean, when I was learning, you know, if you're very mathematical and you learn algebraic geometry, you also use this notation.
Really? Okay.
Yeah. I mean, there's a very fancy way of like making these infinitesimals rigorous using by Grothendieck. But I think for now, for the purposes of understanding this, we should think. Think about your familiarity with the Euler Lagrange equation and use your physics.
Okay.
Okay, so the final thing is the variation of one form just is the boundary term. Phi at t equals 0. So this is some expression in phi and some derivatives of phi, some order, maybe first order, and delta phi. Maybe to say one more time. The Euler, when you solve the Euler Lagrange equations, you throw away the boundary terms. And then you get a manifold of the solutions. But there was a piece that you threw away, the boundary terms. If you put that back, you discover that your manifold is actually symplectic. So let's work this out for a free particle. So now that we're having this discussion, I feel very glad that Giuseppe is going to give you the alternative perspective on this, which is how do you go from the phase space to the Lagrangian? You just do the Legendre transform. That's great for computation. But I always found it kind of unsatisfying for motivating for everything. Okay, so here's the example of the free particle. So the phase space has coordinates u, phi 0, and p is the derivative of my field of 0. OK, so how do I compute the variational one form? So the Lagrangian of, if I look at the variation of the Lagrangian, is equal to phi del t squared del phi minus del phi and there's a factor of half and that's a plus. So we know that phi satisfies the equations of motion. So let's figure out what this is. Well, as phi satisfies the equations of motion, one of the two terms drops out.
conditions. So one of them is, can we formulate Hamiltonian mechanics without getting into the equation of motion? And the second question is, since we are working with fields, is delta playing the role of like exterior derivative, and the functional derivative now becomes the vector field?
Functional derivative. I mean, this is, I think for the second question, yes. I mean, delta phi is, well, it's certainly related to the exterior derivative on the symplectic manifold. The first question, were you wondering if there's like a kind of an off-shell Hamiltonian mechanics? No, Hamiltonian mechanics is on-shell. But that's not so bad, right? Because firstly, everything classical is on-shell. And in quantum things, you never see on-shell things anyway, off-shell things anyway. They're just like virtual processes which wash out at the end of the day.
Sorry. So this approach makes it look like delta itself is an exterior derivative on a separate space, right?
Yes.
The case, then should a symplectic form in this case be a delta of alpha rather than d of alpha, because they are different exterior derivatives, right? Are we mixing these two liberally?
Let's see. So I think the notation is a little confusing. So the delta is about the exterior derivatives on the space of field configuration. But now the phase space is a submanifold of the space of field configurations. So delta on field configurations and d on the phase space, those are really the same.
Wow.
It's just the traditional notation for variation on the space of field configurations is always given by delta. That's how we always learned it when we look at the Euler-Legrand equations. That's the source of the confusion. The other place where one differentiates is on time, and that's definitely different.
Yeah. How did the dp delta phi reduce to dp?
Yeah. Well, let's write phi equals u plus pt, and then delta phi is delta q plus t delta p. Right, so now I can do this because this is a way of parameterizing all solutions. So delta phi is a variation among the solutions. Like it also is. Now if I look at it this way and insert this in, I'll find delta p, which is dp.
Why can't we so easily interchange between delta and d?
What's that, sorry?
Why can't we interchange between delta and d so easily? Why are they equivalent?
Well, let's see. So we always use delta when we think of, you know, the configurations of fields. But it really does mean the same thing as d. Suppose I have some kind of coordinates on my space of field configurations, and delta of those coordinates is the same thing as d of those coordinates.
Yeah, but if you say that, couldn't you also say the delta of my field in the field configuration space could also be d of phi? So could you have just rewritten everything from the start with d instead of delta?
Yes, you could have, but I think I would have thought that would be confusing, because if I had a field and I write d phi, then you think, oh, I'm differentiating it with respect to time, but you're not. We're looking at the variations of it. So when we look at the space of fields, it's easy to be confused between differentiating on the space of fields, which we write like this, or differentiating in time, which we write like this. And you kind of want to have notation, which makes them very different. Is this class like an hour and a half, right?
Yeah.
Which is a long class. I mean, because the last thing I wanted to explain is how do we get, if we know as we do, we start from the Lagrangian, we build a phase space, and we build its symplectic form, how do we get Hamiltonian? Turns out to be much easier than figuring out the variational one form. So if phi satisfies the equations of motion, then so does say phi plus I can differentiate my field in time, and it will still satisfy the equations of motion. What did I say? What epsilon? Or if you prefer, you could do a finite time translation. Sorry, I'm just, in the case of a free field, I don't need to worry about this. There's just a subtlety with the fields, with the directions. You have to put it this way. So the time derivative is a flow on the phase space. So the Hamiltonian is the function so that x of h, this vector field, is equal to this time derivative vector.
Do you have a rigorous definition of flow, or do you just mean like it, you know?
The vector field.
Huh? Oh.
That's the intuitive definition. It's you move a point around, but it's the rigorous definition is at each point you have a tangent vector. Ah. That tells you in the direction in which you move.
Can I take a step back 1 second?
Yeah.
This seems a little bit like a magical formulation, like we're just like finding this alpha and then it like magically turns out to the form we want. Is there like an intuition why it works so well?
I have to say, it is a little magical. Yeah, I feel the whole. I think everything about the Hamiltonian formulation is a little magical, because it seems really natural to us now. I think that we see, oh, symplectic manifolds. Of course, it's classical mechanics. But why this alternating form? What is that going to do with anything? It just seems really. At first, it must have seemed extremely strange. And I certainly agree. I don't have an extremely sharp way of getting this, of like understanding why this is the right thing to do. Perhaps we'll get a better understanding when we try to go the other way and start from the Hamiltonian picture and build a Hamiltonian.
For the definition we gave to alpha, we are doing something like the integral of the derivative of the Lagrangian, which could be like the integral of, like the derivative of the axion.
Yes, exactly.
Alpha, are we saying somehow that the axion is a one form? Is this like the axion on cell?
Yes, that's a really great way of saying it, right? This is like, that's an excellent way of saying it. Yeah, okay, I think you said it really well. So normally you might think, so S is, you might think of it as a function on space of fields. But this is not really true. Because of convergence. And I think what you just said, and I think that's correct, is we should think alpha as being roughly one form, which is like ds. The subtlety is that d alpha is not zero, whereas you might expect ds to be zero, squared to zero. But I still think this is morally true, because s doesn't really make sense. It's not surprising that d of it is not zero.
What did you mean because of convergence? I don't understand.
Oh, you know, s is like and I suppose phi is like a polynomial. Think of that. That integral just doesn't make sense. And s comes from the, you know, boundary terms of that integral. So
there's no like geometric way of understanding s?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is kind of the closest to what S is, I think, this alpha. Like on, you know, on, if time extends infinitely, then S just really doesn't make sense.
Can you explain a little bit more? You said alpha is like the one form which is like DS, which kind of looks like it. Why do we want DS? Because you want to. Where do you want DS?
Well, if I had a function, there's very little difference between the function f and the one form df. Mm-hmm. You can recover f by integrating df.
Yeah.
So if you wanted to know about s, maybe that was hard, you might try to study this instead. And alpha kind of contains that information. Like you differentiate the Lagrangian and look at the boundary.
Yeah.
I feel like there must be a better way of understanding alpha going along these lines. Maybe let me finish the discussion of the Hamiltonian, because this is really easy. And so the Hamiltonian is, you know, on the phase space where I defined it in terms of solutions of the equations of motion. You can obviously differentiate with respect to time because my Lagrangian was time independent. So I have that symmetry. The Hamiltonian is just the thing generating that symmetry. So let's compute it. For a free field, we have, well, this is really silly, you know, u is phi 0. E is del t phi at 0. So the symmetry goes like this. Now, the variation of P is Q. So that tells us that this vector field H must be in this right. E del Q. So let's see if we did a more complicated example. So I add out a mass term. This is going to give us the harmonic oscillator. Well, the phase space is as before. E del t phi 0 u phi at 0. But now we also have, well, p is the derivative of q. Well, we also have that. If I look at the equations of motion, I vary phi, del t squared phi is equal to minus phi. So this equation tells us that u is equal to minus the derivative p. So we look there and we see that the vector field has to be E del Q for this term that you know, P is the derivative of Q minus Q del Q. So the Hamiltonian half P squared plus Q squared. So this is the harmonic oscillator. OK, so now there's a fun game you can play, which is going to be described in the homework. Take your Lagrangian, you assume it starts like this. And then you add on anything you like over here, any potential, whatever. What is the Hamiltonian? And you can just churn through these differential equations and figure it out. But the Legendre transform is a clever way of doing it.
Do you mean variation of P is Q dot?
Sorry. Let me write this better. Let me write up the right to there. So you want like del T of anything X. Excuse me. X of Q is P. Okay, are there any more questions? I thought I might stop a little early, so long time.
Sorry, maybe this is just a matter of abuse of terminology. So Q and P in your example, right, is essentially initial data, right?
Exactly, the Cauchy data.
No, you also wrote P is a partial derivative of Q. So I don't know what that means because Q right now is just a number, right? It's not a function of Q.
Well, the phase space is solutions to the equations of motion. Any solution to the equations of motion, I can slide it around in time. So P and Q are functions on the phase space.
Okay, so you are identifying already that the space of solution is isomorphic to the space of initial data.
Yes.
Okay.
So we see this here, right? In this example, the initial data is the same. So P and Q, but the global solutions are different because the equations of motion are different. And that means I get this extra term here.
So in quantum mechanics, we cannot write alpha as ds dtp, and that's why we won't have a symplectic structure.
In quantum mechanics?
Because equations are not one shell, and it's not necessary that the variation of the action is zero.
When you actually do quantum mechanics, you work on shell. If you have P, you have Q, canonically. What changes is that Poisson bracket becomes a canonical commutator.
I meant in the path integral formalism, we take exponential of S, but we take all possible variations of S as well.
Yes.
Five, zero.
But the what happens in the path integral formulation is that we don't throw away the on-shell condition entirely. Right? Remember the kind of correspondence principle. So the on-shell condition, which is the equations of motion, gets replaced by the condition that something is a total derivative in the path. So there's some kind of deformation of the whole story. That makes sense? Because it's leading order in H-bar being a total derivative in the path integral is the on-shell condition.
The
respect to the functional measure. Because if I differentiate e to the s, you get the on-shell conditions. But then there's another term from the measure. Okay, are there any other? Yeah.
Could it make somehow clear why the Legendre transformation works always regardless of whether the system is regular or not? Whereas here it seems as if we really have to find a solution to construct a Hamiltonian.
The only thing I can say is I've never been happy with the Legendre transformation. It just felt like an algorithm you were given with no proper motivation for why it was the right thing to do. So I feel this is the right thing to do. And if you could prove that this equals the Legendre transformation, then the Legendre transformation is correct. So why not?
Is the fact that we can, for the previous paper, the fact that we can write the variation of the Legendre assured by the Euler model?
Exactly, yes, absolutely.
Is there a way that you like, see that in the previous
I bet there is, but I mean, there's another. If you like, there's another way to build a variational one form without going through that step. You might like that better. So instead of looking at, you take phi and some variation, and then we say del phi hat is equal to this variation tilde when t is near zero. And we want it to vanish when t goes off to infinity. Now, the variational one form, alpha phi del phi, is equal to the integral like this. Let's see. So I know this isn't really answering your question, but it's a way of writing it which doesn't go through that step. You might worry, so in this step, the older Lagrange equations make an appearance too, because you say, well, I have my original phi, and I have my original del phi, and I've damped it off at infinity. There's loads of ways of doing that. But why is it independent of that choice? Well, different choices, the difference between them will be zero by the order of the Lagrange equations.
So I can think of my field as a section from space-time manifold to some field space.
Yes.
And in space-time manifold, the vector space is spanned by partial derivatives. But in the field space, the vector space is spanned by functional derivatives. Is that the correct way to visualize this?
Yes. The field space is the space of such maps. So in the quantum mechanical or classical mechanical system, the field space is the space of paths in whatever my other manifold is. Then, yes, vector fields and so on. Exterior derivatives are all about functional derivatives.
One question about what Vincent asked. Here, and related with the previous discussion, like we always can change the derivative and the integral in the axiom? Like there's no... Okay.
We can always... Sorry, I didn't quite...
Like, there, we would have... like we know that that is going to be... That is going to be the like the integrand. We are going to be able to write it as a total derivative of something.
Yes.
My question is: aren't we changing like derivatives outside of the integral in the definition of the axiom, and derivatives inside? Is that relevant?
Oh, that's a subtle question for the same reason as the thing you brought up earlier, because you know the integral. An expression like this, integral of L phi, this is ill-defined. Because it's an integral over the real line of some quantity which may go to infinity at the other end. Whereas these kinds of things are much better defined. Now, if I vary it by adding on something which goes to zero at infinity, that's then I've got rid of the problems at infinity.
And my question, I think, would be like the variation of that integral is always the integral of the variation of the integral, and that is okay.
That's okay, but as long as the integral makes sense, it's okay. But the integral normally often doesn't make sense.
And I had another question about the two form that we wrote. Like you said in the beginning of the class that it was that it was important the minus sign when in quantum field theory too, when we did like weak rotations, we saw that that minus sign changes and it's not a minus sign anymore.
I think it's a different minus sign. When you do a weak rotation, this minus sign here changes to a plus. It's not the minus sign that appears in the antisymmetry of the two form.
I have another question about the variations, because it's a bit physically strange to me, because in the when you say the tangent plane is a tangent space is a variation,
mm-hmm.
That's a variation on the, like you're already on shell and you're varying.
Yes, exactly.
But then the variation in the Lagrangian, it seems that you have variation over different t.
What do you mean over different t?
Because
you're integrating over T, right? Like,
yes.
Like, I can't make that.
Well,
because one is like you're varying the initial condition.
Oh no, you shouldn't think too much about the initial conditions. Right, so the phase space you should really think of as solutions for all time. I mean, okay, there might be subtleties in when we're not dealing with such a simple case. But the phase space is really solutions of the field equations. The initial, when I choose t equals zero, I mean, you choose initial conditions at t equals zero, that gives you coordinates. I choose them at some other value of t, that gives me a different coordinates. Ultimately, the choice of coordinates is not that important.
I'm sorry, this is a very basic question.
Uh-huh.
Follow how you got the vector field x equals p dq.
Yeah, I think I explained that really badly. So, wait. There's a vector field which sends, say, p to. I want to think of a vector field as something that takes a function to a function. Are you familiar with this interpretation of a vector field? It's like they can differentiate a function. So it sends p to the time derivative. So what I want to do is calculate this vector field. So since q is phi of 0 and p is del t phi of 0, call this vector field x. We must have x q is equal to, well, what's the time derivative of q? That's p. And in this case of a free field, let's include a mass as m squared phi squared. We must send x p is minus m squared. So what's x? X is p del q minus m squared q del p. Is that a better derivation?
Yes, thank you.
Why is this different than Lagrangian without deviation?
You take a field configuration. A field configuration can have any behavior you like. It can grow like a polynomial or something. It can be constant when time is very positive or very negative. So I get an integral over time of something which goes to infinity at either end. So.
Can I understand, I was thinking about the total derivative thing. Can I understand it as, because we're varying the action on shell, that means the final variation of the action has to be a function of the endpoints rather than...
Yes.
So it has to be a total derivative.
That's what, yes, I sorry I didn't say that earlier. Absolutely right. We're varying the action on shell, which means whatever happens in the middle doesn't matter because it's on shell. Only in the boundary terms. And then the variation one form is you take one of those managers.
Okay.
I mean, we could have set it for a finite interval. That might have been better. If you wanted to get rid of all these issues, we say, you know, I integrate my Lagrangian from 0 to 1, and the variation as a contribution from 0 minus contribution from 1, we take up one of them.
Sorry, last. So this process of, I guess, our goal was to find the Hamiltonian, but instead we found, at least first found the Hamiltonian vector field by
this
condition that like XH should be the time derivative.
Yes.
So we still have to then either like use the symplectic form or use the definition of like integral curves to find the actual Hamiltonian.
Absolutely, yes. Yeah.
There's no way to like cheat around that. You still have to actually, like, I guess use the symplectic form would be probably the simplest way.
Yeah, I think there's no way around it because I think the Lagrangian doesn't even tell you the Hamiltonian. It tells you the Hamiltonian up to an additive constant.
Yeah.
Total energy. I mean, that there is a question is like not every vector field comes from a Hamiltonian. There's a condition, and you have to you do have to check that that condition is satisfied, but it is. Okay, so I think I'll stop there, and maybe next time we can try to go the other way.